Welcome to Ryan Talks Tax, a podcast to keep you up to date on the latest developments in Canadian tax and government funding. I'm Jim Day. In this episode, we're going to discuss the 2021 federal budget. More specifically, we'll take a look at some of the key changes to the government's pandemic support programs and other funding initiatives. We'll also take a look at a couple of the interesting sales tax measures introduced in this year's budget. To start with, I'm joined by David Douglas, principal and leader of Ryan's government grants practice, as well as the Scientific Research and Experimental Development, also known as SHRED, practice. We'll also be joined by Brian Cardinal, another principal in our SHRED practice, and Aisha Raza and Josh McCory, senior managers in our government grants practice. This year's budget was massive by almost every measure: the size of the deficit, the amount of the spending, the scope of the measures proposed, even the number of pages. I think it was over 700. And all of this at a pivotal time for Canada. David, you've had a chance to take a good look at the budget. What did you think?
Well, Jim, thanks very much. It was one of those budgets which has something in it for everybody. There's a sprinkling of new programs, very focused on investments in green transition, digital transformation. We knew that was coming, so no surprises there. And lots of support for the innovation infrastructure and innovation economy. So those are good things. Now, I find, when I say sprinkling, there are some new programs in there. There are top-ups of many other programs. The list, I think we stopped counting at 30 or 40 programs mentioned in the budget. So very important for you to revisit your strategy, revisit your business plan, understand how the individual programs are going to impact you, and really revisit what the funding programs can do for you, particularly if you have a green project, particularly if, as you come out of this pandemic, that you're hiring and training people, particularly if you're marketing globally and trying to export more, develop business on a broader scale, there are programs for that. COVID relief measures, why don't you talk for a minute about what those look like, some extensions and some new programs to talk about there. So why don't you spend a few minutes guiding us on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So both the Canada Emergency Wage Subsidy and the Rent Subsidy programs have been extended. One of the largest commitments made in the federal budget is for the wage subsidy. Now, this is a $10.1 billion extension to the existing program. As you know, previously the program was to conclude on June of this year with period 16, but the extended program will now conclude in September of this year with four additional recovery periods. And there's also potential that the STUs will be extended further to November if the economic and public health situation does not improve by then. One of the proposed changes we've noticed about this extension is the gradual phasing out of the subsidy rates as we approach to the new tail end of the program, which again is set to September of 2021. There's also a gradual narrowing of the eligibility of employers. So for instance, starting with the July 4th period, employers will need to experience a minimum of a 10% reduction in revenue in order to qualify for the program. Unlike under the current guidelines going up to period 16, where any reduction in revenue would have qualified. Another notable change that's been announced is a reduction of the maximum weekly subsidy amount for the employees. So you may recall from the start of the program, the maximum subsidy amount was $847 per employee per week. However, for these four extended periods, the maximum subsidy will now decline from $847 to $677 in July, and then eventually $226 by the end of the program. As you can imagine, the calculation formula used for the base rate and top-up rate has also changed, and it will complement this sliding scale of the maximum subsidy amount. So while the opportunity has slightly narrowed, it is still certainly a very large opportunity yet. The main purpose of the program remains the same, that is to keep Canadians employed. However, the CEWS has been a complex program since the get-go. We've seen numerous changes and revisions to eligibility of employees, employers, and qualifying revenue, but this extension to the program poses further complexities that may confuse employers wanting to make applications for funding. Just as an example, with the new rules surrounding eligibility, employers would need to take a deep dive into the legislation and guidelines to interpret how they can optimize their claims. One major caveat is for public companies accessing this program. So the budget proposes that beginning June 5th, publicly listed companies will be required to pay back their wage subsidies if their most highly compensated executives' total compensation for this year exceeds their aggregate compensation from 2019. So public companies will now need to ask themselves if it is worthwhile to apply for the wage subsidy and have to pay it back, essentially. Another complication we see is for Canadian employers. So the budget proposes a new Canada Recovery hiring program only for CCPCs. It will overlap with the CEWS extension period with similar rates, but it will continue on for an additional 2 months beyond the CEWS deadline. While the program sounds promising, it does have certain restrictions that CEWS allows, such as the treatment of employees on leave. So with competing programming for Canadian-controlled private corporations, employers will need to navigate the intricacies of both programs and see which one provides a greater benefit. We would absolutely encourage all businesses to take advantage of these upcoming and extended programs, but we would also encourage them to ask themselves what will be the impacts of accessing these funds on their existing business plans. What about other incentive programs that they are participating in? The complexity is greater because these programs are and will be more time sensitive and definitely have overlap with existing credits and incentives programming. And I think this is really where Ryan's expertise are invaluable, and we can help our clients navigate through and mitigate these complexities.
Well said, Aisha. And I guess what I'm hearing then is that, you know, the fact patterns for each company are going to be very different, and you really have to revisit those fact patterns given your current situation, your management, whether you're public or private. All of that has changed somewhat, and the formulas have changed again. So a lot of complexity to look at. And so revisiting your business plan, revisiting the programs and its impact on other areas of your business is fundamental. Having said that, lots of other programs out there that have been introduced, and new accelerator on the green incentive side. Josh, do you want to walk us through some of your top hit list for some of those programs that have been announced?
Yeah, definitely, David. And as you alluded to, this budget has had a tremendous impact on the government grants landscape. Aisha alluded to the large amounts that have been allocated to the COVID relief extensions. There's also been significant spending on the economy rebound to pre-crisis levels. Funding for innovation really absorbs the greatest amount of the contributions outlined in the budget, particularly in the areas of environmental sustainability, life sciences and biomanufacturing, aerospace, and then other industries that have previously lacked government spending, such as tourism and hospitality, will now be supported because of the detrimental impact that COVID has had to the sector. So we can expect to see more grants in the areas of tourism, heritage, and culture. And then not necessarily as a new initiative, but the government has acknowledged that young professionals have been greatly impacted by COVID-19. So we do expect that there will be numerous grant programs to support new hires, both full-time and co-op positions, over and above the COVID relief programs and the new COVID recovery program that Aisha mentioned. With the magnitude of spending, this budget really addresses a lot of different industries. And with substantial funding commitments, it may really be a good time, like you said, David, to revisit the business strategy and how government grants can play into the overall strategy. The budget was somewhat silent on the Scientific Research and Experimental Development Tax Credit Program, but Brian, maybe you can touch upon how government grants may impact the SR and EV credit.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. While the budget was silent on direct changes to the SR&ED program, all these other funding opportunities that were announced will have an indirect impact. SR&ED claimants need to be aware that other government funding, it'll need to be evaluated under the government assistance rules to determine the extent that it's in respect of SR&ED. Since the government assistance in respect of SR&ED will reduce qualified expenditures for the SR&ED, tax credit. Now, sometimes the other funding will be entirely in respect of SR&ED, but more often only a portion of it is SR&ED government assistance. That emergency wage subsidy that Aisha was talking about earlier is in respect, for example, of an employee's entire salary, not just the SR&ED eligible portion. So it should be allocated between both SR&ED and non-SR&ED activities. It's not necessary to take that SUSE and directly apply it 100% against your SR&ED claim. Now, the other good news is that most of these programs will stack with your SR&ED claim. So even though the SR&ED is reduced, it won't be eliminated. So you don't necessarily have to choose between other funding and your SR&ED. You can get value from taking advantage of all the funding opportunities that are out there at the same time. You do need to take care, however, to determine the amount of overlap between SR&ED and other funding carefully to optimize the financial benefit of all the programs that are available.
Thanks, Brian. And thanks to Josh, Aisha, and David for the great insights on those programs. Of course, the budget wasn't all spending and subsidies. In fact, in our tax alert, which you can find on our website at ryan.com/Canada/news and insights, we comment on over a dozen proposed tax measures. Now, with that in mind, we're joined by Jeff Shaw, Senior Manager of Ryan's Client Support Services Group and resident sales tax expert. Jeff, we saw some changes to the GST, HST, e-commerce rules for non-residents included in this year's budget. Those rules don't even take effect until July, and yet we're already seeing some tweaks. What did you think?
Well, it's interesting. So, you know, just to make sure everyone is aware of what's going on, I mean, they're kind of piggybacking on what Quebec did a couple of years ago in introducing a special or a specified registration system. But what they're focusing on is unregistered non-residents that might be supplying digital products or services, digital platform providers like the Amazons, who might be selling on behalf of unregistered non-residents and not collecting tax, and then short-term rental accommodation providers that use digital platforms to sell or rent out their space and not collect tax. They're focusing on this and creating a special registration system to make sure that they get tax revenues on that. In addition to that, they're trying to enforce these big digital platforms, again, like the Amazons, to ensure that they're collecting tax under the regular rules as is required, that may not be happening. And so that was all announced in the fall in late March. And so that's going to go into effect on July 1st. Now, you know, from the perspective of most of our clients who are GST registered, it's not really a big deal. You know, they're registered, and so they'll collect tax or should be collecting tax under the regular rules. But, you know, we have to remember that a lot of our clients could be subsidiaries or could have related parties outside of Canada, in particular in the US. And it's those organizations, some of our clients' related parties, that, it, you know, if they begin or make supplies into Canada, they may get caught by these e-commerce rules. And so, you know, I think our clients need to talk to their subs and their parents and just find out what's going on and whether they have a potential issue with these new rules that they may have. You know, just as an example, I know a lot of U.S. companies are setting up their e-commerce sales, their online sales, and they're working in tandem with Canadian logistics companies and having their goods located in Canada. That may be enough to trigger some of these rules that we're talking about if they're not registered. And you know, they may get caught up either by their logistics provider having to collect tax or being forced to register because someone else isn't collecting the tax. So a lot of different angles here on how you could get it caught. All that said, that wasn't really introduced in this budget, but what they have done is already made some changes. And I think some of them make some sense. You know, under these rules now, the two parties, the person who's required to collect the tax, like maybe the digital platform and the third party that they're representing, are going to be jointly and severally liable for the tax. That means, you know, if something goes wrong or they're misinformed by the non-resident, they're not going to be completely on the hook for the tax. It's a shared responsibility. To the benefit of people who are purchasing things from these suppliers, under the simplified registration system, the consumer is going to be able to take advantage of some of the point of sale rebates that are available, and so won't get saddled with the full HST on things like books and maybe some other things that have some relief built into them. And I think one of the other things that's important too is they've added in bad debt relief. So, you know, if you're caught by these rules and your customer doesn't pay you and doesn't pay you for the tax, you may be able to get some relief under the bad debt rules and not be on the hook for some tax that someone didn't pay you for in the first place. And I think one of the other things that's really important from my perspective is, you know, these rules are complex. They're a little bit confusing. There's new terminology. And so it may take a little bit of time for people who need to register under these systems to understand and get compliant. And so the CRA is supposed to exercise some discretion and some leniency, at least for a year, which may make it a little easier to comply with these rules.
Yeah, discretion and leniency. Those are always good words to hear when you're talking about the CRA. Hopefully,
<Yeah.
laughs> any clients that get caught, you know, under those rules can count on that. I know after I noticed that they made a change with respect to input tax credits documentary requirements, not the requirements themselves, but I think they made a change to some of the thresholds for those requirements. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, sure. Exactly. There's some positive changes in there. The level of documentation to actually prove that tax was paid in terms of claiming an input tax credit come in phases. And, you know, the more expensive the item is, the more documentation you have to have. And those thresholds really haven't changed since the inception. And yet, you know, the economy has grown and inflation has grown. And so maybe the old limits are outdated. And so they have said that they're going to change those thresholds. They're going to move the lowest threshold from $30 to $100. And then the next threshold from $150 to $500. And I think that's got some benefits. There's now some lower dollar transactions that are going to require less supporting documentation, to the point where maybe all you need is a GST registration number and the name of the customer. And that may just make it easier to claim input tax credits. And the one area I'm thinking about is employee expense reimbursements, which tend to fall in that $30 to $100 range. You may now need less documentation than was required in the past. And so that just may make it easier to claim input tax credits on these and face less scrutiny under audit because of that fact.
Yeah, that would be good news because those smaller dollar item purchases really, sometimes it seems a little bit onerous, you know, to have all of that extra information to substantiate those input tax credits. So maybe that will be a good thing.
I think it's a positive. And anytime they can release some of the onerous burden that's placed on input tax credit claims, everyone's better off.
Yeah, for sure. I know there was a lot of speculation, you know, leading into the budget about a possible wealth tax. We didn't see a wealth tax, but it's interesting. We did see something like four new taxes. Did any of them sort of jump out at you?
Well, I mean, there's one that I guess verges on wealth taxes. They've added an extra tax on what they call select luxury goods, but what they're focusing on is what they term luxury cars and personal aircraft. So, you know, I think we've got a limited target, but, you know, in that category, they're aiming at purchases over $100,000, which, you know, it doesn't take much time to get a car up to $100,000 these days. So, you know, maybe luxury is not the right term on it. And then they're also focusing on boats over $250,000. So, you know, they've adding this tax on it. You know, I guess the part that I'm a little bit confused about is the cars, because, you know, we keep hearing the federal government talk to us about this green plan and going environmental friendly and all this sort of stuff. And so, you know, that would, you know, kind of encourage people to use these electric cars, you know, the Teslas and all that sort of stuff, which from my perspective, I mean, I'm not a car expert, but from my perspective, they tend to be expensive cars. They tend to be cars that could be caught in that $100,000 price and now taxed at a higher rate, you know, another additional, you know, say 10% tax on it. You know, is that not going counter to their policy of working for a green environment? You know, someone might decide not to buy the electric car because they're going to have to pay more tax. It just doesn't seem to be in sync. I really don't have an issue on the aircraft and the boats. I think those tend to be luxury items. The car one I find a little bit surprising. So I think that's interesting. The other thing that's interesting about it is this is a tax that's separate and distinct from the GST. And the way they've structured it is, you know, you'll buy the item, you know, the $100,000 car, and then you'll apply this luxury tax on it, and then the GST on top of that. So, you know, you're going to count two ways, one for the extra tax and then additional GST and HST on it. And, you know, this is aimed at personal expenses. So this is going to be all, in theory, unrecoverable tax. It could be a significant windfall to the government based on this added tax. The other tax that they've added from a commodity tax perspective is probably not a big surprise. I think virtually every jurisdiction in Canada now has some sort of tax on vaping products. And so we don't know the exact start time for this, but it's going to be sometime in 2022. My guess it'll be January 1st, but you never know. But that seems to be the trend, that there seems to be this extra tax on vaping products, and I think it's there to prevent the consumption of these products, which, you know, ultimately could be presenting a health risk. Preventing that consumption in the volumes that it is now, and certainly trying to deter younger people from going down this route. So another interesting little tax, but not a surprise, because it's kind of sweeping the nation.
Yeah, I would say, given what we've seen at the provincial level, that's not really a surprise that they're going to tax vaping products. And I agree with you regarding the tax on luxury goods. Kind of runs counter to what they're trying to accomplish when you talk about an electric vehicle. I think that's a really good insight there. There might be an unintended consequence in introducing that tax. You certainly don't want to discourage people from buying electric. Just the opposite, in fact. I think there's other measures introduced to try to accelerate CCA and for more energy efficient items and items involving electricity. So really strange that they would inadvertently put an extra tax on top of those vehicles. As far as it being, the tax being calculated, GST, HST included, everybody loves tax on tax, right? I mean, that'll probably end up being the most controversial part of that measure. But great insights, Jeff. Thank you.
Okay, great.
That concludes this episode of Ryan Talks Tax. For more information on the 2021 federal budget, check out our website at ryan.com/Canada/news and insights. And please let us know what you think about the podcast. You can send your questions, comments, and suggestions to webinars@ryan.com. Thanks for listening.